This is an ABC podcast.
Just outside the town of Broome in the Kimberley region of northwest Australia, there's a point on the coast where you can stand there and look out and you'll see red earth with a slash of turquoise sea and a slab of dazzling blue sky. The Kimberley is one of the most startlingly lovely places in the world, and it tends to get under your skin. And Broome itself is a unique place. It's a town that's been home to traders and graziers and pearl divers from all over the world, and of course to the original Indigenous people who have lived here for tens of thousands of years. Dr. Anne Polina is the Managing Director of an Indigenous not-for-profit organisation that's called Madjula, which is based in Broome, and has a bunch of degrees and diplomas in health, education and public policy. Anne grew up here. Her dad was a pearl diver and a fisherman, and her family gave her the old culture and stories about the land, the sea and the sky. Hello, Anne. Welcome.
Mabubara, ngajinu nilawala Anne Polina, ngayu imarawara manan, ngamandajara nyigina, ngayu nyigina nganga. Good day. I'm talking to you on the beautiful country of Broome. It's an amazing place. And in my language, I said that I am a woman from the Fitzroy River who belongs to the Fitzroy River. So in terms of the river owns me. But Broome is my home, and it's an amazing place full of wonderful memories and great people and many, many stories. Thank you, Richard.
There's something epic, like I said, about the landscape of the Kimberley. What do you know about how long people have been living here and the lives of people as they were before Europeans came?
Yeah, well, a couple of years ago I became familiar with some of the work that was being done by the Yawuru people in regards to Roebuck Bay. My brother and my brother-in-law were involved in building the road between Port Hedland and Broome, and as part of that process they were uncovering huge clamshells and reburying them, and I sort of let that memory go. And then in recent years I found out through the Yawuru people, who had been working with some amazing scientists around Roebuck Bay, was that the bay actually had been a deep water sanctuary, and so these clamshells were significant of that. But some of the scientific work that was done through the Yawuru organisation with Dr. Vic Seminook, which was showing that as the bay infilled, you could see a migration pattern of Aboriginal people moving back through the cultural landscape. And so these middens that were uncovered were able to show and showcase and tell the story of a deep history in time of how Aboriginal people had formed this deep relationship with country, the sea country. And as they moved back in time, as the bay filled, this sort of scientific record is implanted in this living memory today.
So people have been doing what I did when I came here, which is to sort of feel the slightly paradise-like nature of this part of the world, helping themselves to fish and seafood and relaxing and enjoying themselves, I suppose.
Yeah, no, Broome's an amazing place. Many Aboriginal people continue to go to the other side of the bay because, from what I understand, that's originally where they were going to set up the town site. But because of difficulty with water, they moved back. So even today on the weekends, if you go to the other side of the bay, you will see Aboriginal people hunting and gathering and collecting fish and middens and crab. And what's really wonderful is the new families that have come to Broome, the non-Indigenous families who are actually married into Aboriginal people or just like to explore these amazing spaces. They're going over there, they're hunting, and, you know, Facebook is showing how they're putting up on the Facebook their little recipes for chili crab and all of those sorts of things. So it is an amazing place that shows you that Aboriginal people still today can continue to live in an abundance of food gathering and food sourcing and food sharing.
We know that there have been points of communication along between various Aboriginal peoples and nations, if you like, around Australia. What do you know about how far people would walk from here, from the Kimberley? How far would they travel following the song lines?
I think that's a very important point. Prior to colonisation or invasion, depending on your point of view, Aboriginal people in the Kimberley had a system of governance called the Wunan Law. And the Wunan Law was a regional governance model that involved trade and ceremony and exchange of marriage. But it was also a law system based on law of the land or provincial law. So the desert, the sea, the hill country, the river, we all had our own sets of codes of conduct and law and those values and ethics that guided us and protected us and created civil society. So from the Wunan Law, what we hear is the stories from the elders that say how the law and the song lines travelled from the hill country, from the sunrise country to the sundown country, and the sundown country being around Broome and James Price Point or Walmerdon. So we know that these stories are there because they're held in song. And these song lines connected people to Uluru. And so, as I said...
To Uluru. That's a very long way from here.
That's a very, very long way. And 30 years ago, I met an amazing Aboriginal man from Luma community, and he was actually blind. And he would say to us when we were sitting around the fires how he would sing his way through the song lines, through the storying, and travel all the way to Uluru. So, you know, this is an amazing system of knowledge, of sharing, of mapping. But this is a blind man doing this.
That's astonishing. That would have taken months to walk that distance, I would have thought. And in doing so, the country changes so much, changes so profoundly. As you go from the saltwater territory here, going further inland into scrub and then to desert. How would people survive, I wonder, when they would go from place to place? How would they know where to find water and where to find food?
I think one of the key things is that the song lines are the maps. And I know, having spent a lot of time out in the remote communities and travelling through my river country, when we've gone with elders, all of these special places, the elders would say, oh, just go over here and just dig in the sand and see what you find. And we'd dig in the sand and we'd find instruments like, carrying bowls, stone axes, stone tools. So the people would leave them in these places. So everywhere that people travel through the landscape, the resources would be connected to that sense of place.
Can you tell me how that knowledge presents itself to you? I'm assuming you've got some of this too, Anne. Because it's kind of like an encyclopedia, I suppose, in your head. How do you draw on that knowledge?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think one of the things that I've been blessed with is the opportunity to, as a scientist, we'd say, triangulate. But to get different stories from all the different elders, from the hill country, from the desert, from the sea, and get them to tell me stories and see the similarities in terms of what was the sameness about travelling through the landscape. So I think that's really important in terms of understanding that Aboriginal people have a wisdom and a knowledge system, and I think that is something that we really want to share with fellow Australians and indeed the world.
Yeah, tens of thousands of years of trial and error, of living in the land, of knowing what works, what doesn't work, to observe the changes. It's a kind of a long-term thinking that the country can only benefit from.
Yeah, no, it's a deep history and a deep connection to the landscape, which is portrayed and transferred through songs and through storying, and that opportunity to really understand what that connection to that deep relationship with country is for Aboriginal people and with Aboriginal people.
And tell me about your dad. Where did he come from?
Yeah, my father. He was an amazing man. He came from West Timor. In about 1935, there was a huge cyclone in Broome that took out quite a lot of the luggers, because prior to that, the pearling divers were mainly Japanese. And so with that a big cyclone, there was a real need to recruit Asian men from many other countries. So my father saw it as an opportunity and he came to Broome. Part of the journey was that my father was also a Dutch national. And so as part of being a Dutch national, he was also in the Dutch Merchant Navy. So he was, you know, indentured to the Navy and spent quite a lot of time travelling across Northern Australia with the Dutch Navy, also travelling down to Melbourne and Sydney. And so, yeah, he did spend quite a lot of time in that area.
So he came here in the 1930s. Now, this was a time when the White Australia policy was operational in Australia, and under normal circumstances, someone like him probably wouldn't have been allowed to come in. What made Broome special when it came to the White Australia policy?
Yeah, I think in terms of the White Australia policy, to some extent, what we're talking about is a demand on labour and economics and all of those things, and sometimes those sorts of public policies can be put aside. But one of the things was that they really needed to bring Asian labour, Asian men, to the country to work the pearling industry. And there are many, many stories written about the Asian divers and their resilience and their ability to cope in such a harsh industry. At that time, it was an exceptionally hard workforce to be in and to survive. Many of the men did die from the bends. My father would go away and they would camp, down the Pilbara coast for 1 to 3 months at a time.
What did the pearl diving actually involve in those days?
Pearl diving in those days...
Do they have equipment of any kind?
Yeah, people know the story of the hard hat divers.
I don't know that story. What is that?
Well, I mean, if you go down to the Broome Museum, you'll see what the diving suit actually looked like. And it was, these great, heavy, helmets that were rigged on men, but before they even suited up, they had to wear several layers of woolen clothing to keep warm, because they would be underneath for many, many hours and wearing huge long boots. And so they would spend a lot of the time, my father would say, from sun up to sundown.
So they were wearing like those outfits you sometimes see little figurines in fish tanks wearing, like the big round space helmet almost and the big loose suit. And was there a tube connecting?
There was a tube that connected the air supply system, and so there were tenders on the top of the luggers that would hand pump the air down to the divers and keep them alive and keep them well.
What could possibly go wrong with that system, Anne, I wonder? I mean, that must have been a dangerous work.
Yeah, dangerous work, and also dragging in terms of being on the bottom for such long periods of time. So, yeah, I think if you take a walk to the Japanese cemetery, there are many, many men whose lives were cut short. And, it took a certain calibre of men to be able to survive, read the seascape, but also manage their pearling crew.
What were they looking for down there? Just pearls or shells?
It was a time before plastic, and so pearl shell, which really what was they were after, were the buttons, were the ornaments, cutlery, all of these sorts of finery that people needed to grace their beautiful homes all across the world and across the planet. It's really interesting because my father was well known as being one of the strongest and capable divers in the region, and he told me a story of Jacques Cousteau. Jacques Cousteau came here to the Kimberleys and basically put a challenge out there in terms of he needed the best diver in Broome to go down into what we call the whirlpool in the King Sound. And everyone said, oh, you need Simon Pelina. So my father went out with him and went down to the bottom of the ocean at the King Sound around the whirlpool and came up with what they call virgin shell. He was bleeding from his ears and his eyes, and Jacques Cousteau knew he'd gone down there. And Jacques Cousteau must have said to his son, look, one day you must go to Broome and you must find Simeon Pelina. And several years ago, Jacques Cousteau's son came to Broome and he said to my father, look, my father had told me that if I wanted to try to be suited up in a full suit, you would be the man that would put me down. And so my father started to dress Jacques Cousteau's son, and he managed, he couldn't cope with the full suit. And he actually went down in a half suit and half dress, what the Asian men would call it, and came up. And you know, all of those memories, I think, is fantastic to know that this is what's come from Broome.
How about your mum? How did your dad meet your mum?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting story, a very special love story. My mother had been married to another gentleman who was very, very senior, and, from what she tells me, he was extremely violent.
When you say senior, do you mean in position or in age?
No, in terms of age. I think he was about 30 years older than her.
Oh.
It was a marriage of convenience that was negotiated between her husband and her father. So my mother was, to some extent, betrothed to the first husband. And he was a man of the times. He was extremely violent. He had a lot of power. And my mother had several children to her first husband. But she was a very intelligent woman. And she was looking for a way of how to escape a violent relationship. And so she'd been putting aside parts of her child endowment so that one day she would escape this relationship. But she made her way to Broome, and I think at the time she had two of her children with her because some of the older ones had been sent off to other relatives. And she was sitting waiting near the airline's office, which was opposite our home in Broome. And she was sitting on a suitcase with a couple of the children, and my father walked past and saw this good, he says, good sort. He approached my mother and he looked at her and he said, what are you doing? Where are you going? And my mother said to him, well, you know, she was in this relationship and she was on her way down to Port Hedland. And he looked at her and thought, oh, Port Hedland. And he said, well, when you go down there, if you find things are tough, you send me a telegram and I'll bring you back. And I'll bring you back with your children and you can all live with me. So
what an extraordinary thing to say. just like a first sight like that.
Yeah, just like that, first sight.
Men do that, you know. Men do fall in love at first sight. Do you think, is that what happened?
My mother got down to Port Hedland and realised it was hard times. And so she sent my father a telegram and came back with three of the children and produced another six. So I'm one of 12. Yes, I'm one of 12. So a very big and wonderful family life.
So tell me about your mum and her people and where she was from.
Yeah, my mother is from the Fitzroy River, the Muddawarra, and she is a Nyingana person. And In about 1896, there was a very large massacre on the St. George Range, and my great-grandmother, her name was Dumbari, she was brought into Nukumba following that massacre, and she fell in love with a travelling man by the name of John Jack Edgar, who was actually married, but they had this, you know, amazing relationship and produced two children, my grandmother and her brother. One of the things which was really unique for the time was that John Jack Edgar gave my grandmother his name, which was not really something that white men would do when they were fraternizing or in relationships with Aboriginal women. So that was very, very unique in terms of he owned up to his responsibility of, you know, being in love with my great-grandmother and producing my grandmother and her brother and giving them the name of the Edgar family. And, here we are today.
So you came along in 1958. Whereabouts were you born?
I was born in Broome, 1957.
And, oh, I got that wrong.
Yeah. Well, I mean, time just goes so quickly, you know, like about a year or so, maybe two as I turned 60. But one of the things that we say in our language is a word called Bugaragara. And there are many different interpretations of that. Some people say the dream time, some people say the dreaming time. But for me and for what I've learned is that that word Bugaragara means the past, the present and the future fused into this moment in time. So we see time as a circular storytelling way. And basically, as I say, you know, one minute I'm being born in 1957 and now I'm looking at how do I complete what we call going down projects. So when we get to this age, what do we leave? What's our transition plan? Where is the hope for the future?
Professor Brian Green, cosmologist, says that that's exactly how physicists understand time. They say if you could somehow stand outside of it, you would see it as one big thing. It would not be an arrow. It would not go from here to there. All these moments would, in the world, in the universe, would coexist simultaneously.
Yeah.
And the passage of time is
exactly
an illusion.
Right. I guess this is that thing that you just said, illusion. What is reality? You know what I mean? When we're moving through time and space and all of these sorts of things. I mean, I knew Aboriginal men that lived down in the central desert, and I used to be so taken back at how they could paint these amazing landscapes, and they would talk to me about how they could move in and out of time and those sorts of things. So I guess it's how do we free up our mind to new thinking and new thought, but if there is a good thought, sometimes it's not always new.
So growing up as a kid in Broome, what do you remember of what the community was like when you were little?
Oh, it was a very beautiful community. It was social cohesion, multiculturalism, you know, lots of ways that we looked at how people cared about each other, cared for each other, particularly where we lived down in Chinatown near the Roebuck Bay. Every moment that I had spare, that's where I'd spend it, in Roebuck Bay, amongst the mangroves, across the other side of the bay with my father. So out of it came this concept of the family, old families of Broome. So those are the Asian Aboriginal families. So, you know, many, many times we'd spend in celebration, the whole community down at the Japanese quarters or the Malay camp or whatever, or the whole of the community would be invited to come and join in and participate in celebrations and just keeping that momentum of a good community spirit going. People feeling connected, people feeling united, people feeling that they have a sense of place and that Broome is their home.
I think it's in Broome. I've never met Aboriginal people so obsessed with curry as I have in Broome. There's a whole way of making curry that's kind of quite localised in this part of the world, isn't there?
Yeah, no, everyone's got their own little secret recipe, whether it's curry, whether it's chilli crab, or whether it's what we call blachang.
Yeah, the dried shrimp paste.
Dried shrimp paste. And I think it's the fusion of, you know, as I said, this is what we're seeing at a much bigger national scale, is a fusion of food and people and conversations. How we bring all of that, you know, beauty and knowledge making and sharing together so that we combine and we build a sense of cohesion and united in civil society.
So with the money your dad was making as a successful pearl diver, tell me about the businesses he set up along the way.
Yeah, well, one of the things as a head diver was my father was responsible for having a boarding house because he was responsible for housing his crew. And so we had an amazing property, two large, very large buildings on the corner of Dampier Terrace and Napier Terrace. And so it was an amazing building right in the middle of Chinatown. And as we got older and my father had moved from the pearling industry, my mother and my father set about setting up the Ocean Blue Laundry. We had a barber shop. We had a boarding house. We had a fish shop. We also had a partnership in terms of being the local undertakers. So we had all of these industries that, you know, were based in our property in Broome, and a very open door policy and open house. And my mother had a principal called Somebody's Son. So because we lived so close to the hotel, there were lots of times when strangers would come to Broome, drink up their money, and then be down and out. And we would always have an open house and bring them in. So Somebody's Son always had a bed at our place.
How about the family home? Was it like one of those classic tin and timber houses that you find here in Broome?
Yeah, originally it was a merchant shop, so it was very large and it had extremely big rooms. And as the family grew, my father divided it up and created bedrooms for all of the children. But it had amazing large verandas, you know, with lattice that enclosed the whole of the building. We had these huge big skylights that we would pull down and let up to allow the wind to come through in the morning and closing it in the evenings. As a child, you kind of figure that that was yours and it will always be yours.
There was a thing called a lugger picnic. What is that? Is that something aboard the Pearl ships? That's the lugger, is it?
Yeah, lugger picnics. A couple of times a year, all of the different luggers that were managed by all the different pearling masters, they would all line up at the Streeters Jetty, and different families would come and get on the different luggers, and we'd actually sail out. All the while, people would be singing and celebrating and sharing food and sharing stories, and we'd get to a point on the horizon where it was time to turn back, and as we turned back, then the luggers would all have a race to see who would be the first lugger to get back to Broome.
Your dad was obviously a very industrious man. Was he a religious man as well?
Yeah, look, when my father came to Broome, he was a Muslim, and he converted to the Anglican Church. And so as I sit here, I look outside the window, I see the Anglican Church, and basically without my father, that church would not be standing. Because a lot of the wealth that my father earned, he put it back into the upkeep of the Anglican Church. He was also a parishioner in the church, and he was involved in baptisms and burials and regularly holding the service when the ministers were usually away out of town.
How about at Christmas time? What would he do for the kids at Christmas?
Yeah, Christmas was something fantastic, particularly for the Aboriginal kids that lived up on the what we call Kennedy Hill or the Town Reserve. What used to happen was every Christmas, my father, who was extremely dark, would dress up in the little Father Christmas suit that he had actually sewn together and handmade, and he would go up to the hill, up to what we call Kennedy Hill, and hand out Christmas presents to many of the young children that were growing up. And it was really interesting because later in life I had lots of town people come to me to say that they remember my father coming up there and sharing and bringing gifts at Christmas time. And then after the presents were handed out, my father would then come back down to our family home and set up all the tables and invite as many Aboriginal people as possible to come and celebrate Christmas Day at our home. And the tables would be all strewn out with this beautiful starch tablecloths, and people would sit around and just feel really special on a wonderful day like Christmas.
For a little while, and you and your family relocated to Derby with your dad, just a bit further up the coast. Tell me about the night you had to go looking for your uncle.
Yeah, no, my uncle was a real character. My father would send him into Derby to get supplies, and he was a bit of a drinker, and so he'd get on a bender, and sometimes we wouldn't see him for a week or so. But there was a time when he didn't come back for almost 10 days, 2 weeks. And my father started to get a bit worried, and he said, oh, I better go and find out what we need to do. And my father went up and he went to where the Aboriginal people were camped on the station. And he came back and he seemed to be quite contented. And I said to him, well, Dad, what do we do? And he said, we walk.
I was six years old.
And my brother was about eight. And we thought, walk. And I said to him, well, what does that mean, Dad? And he said, well, I've been up to see the old people. And what the old people said is that because you're from the land will look after us. And I thought, well, what does that mean, Dad? And he said, well, what they said is that during the day we would rest. And just before the sun went down, he said, if we looked 50 yards ahead of us, what we would see would be a big ball of light that would rise up from the ground and lead us during the night so we could walk and get our way back to Derby. So just before the sun went down in the distance, about 50 yards ahead of us, this huge big ball of light would just come up from the ground and almost like hover. and wait for us. And then as we packed all our gear up and started walking, because it was my father, my brother, and we had a dog called Tippy. And Tippy had basically, Dad would had strapped, you know, some of the things to him, like a blanket and a billy can, and strap him up. And then we'd start to walk, and this thing would just move in front of us, and we would follow it. And it almost seemed like three or four nights that we were walking in some sort of time warp. And as we got towards Derby, the mud flats of Derby, that light disappeared. And it was really interesting because I put the story out of my mind, and then a couple of years ago my older brother said to me, oh, remember when you all got lost and we had the police out looking for you? And I then recounted the story, and he said, yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I thought, wow, you know, that's just validation that I wasn't loopy, that I realised, yeah, that was a true story. So it's hard to describe it as a child, but it was just like magic.
Were you terrified of it initially?
No. We'd spent a couple of years living and working on the land with my father, and we had these two amazing old Aboriginal people. One was called Hairpin and the other was called Milo. And they instilled in us a sense of confidence and security and comfort that the land knew us because we were from the land. We had no concept of fear or worry or uncertainty. So, no, there was no concept of being scared.
Do you long to see it again?
No, not really. Because as I've grown older, there's other triggers or other indicators that make me feel confident that I am safe in that land that I know and I love, both on the Kimberley, on the Fitzroy River, but also in my beautiful home of Broome.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
You went to boarding school in Perth. I wonder what Perth looked like in your eyes.
I guess one of the things is when I decided to go away to boarding school, I felt ready to go. So I was open and receptive to whatever that unknown would be. And as I said, I lived in an amazing hostel and have still got connections with some of the women that also went there from the Kimberley. And, it became a sense of home. So I had no uncertainty or insecurity that I'd left, you know, a small place like Broome and had moved to the big city.
You took up nursing. Why nursing? What attracted you to that?
I think nursing, growing up in a town of Broome, we had an amazing history of the wonderful Martin sisters. So people like Barbara Martin, they went into nursing. The Martin sisters all went into nursing. So it was kind of, okay, this is what the women in Broome who wanted to get a career pathway, this is where the pathway would be into nursing. And I think one of the things too is that coming from the types of families we came from, particularly, you know, the Asian Aboriginal families, there was instilled in us an ethics of care, and so nursing seemed to be the right fit.
Tell me how you met your husband in Perth.
Well, there's two husbands. Mm-hmm. The first one, though we're not legally married, is my wonderful partner, Ian Pedrissett. So we were both in Perth in about 1984, and we'd gone to a land rights rally, and Ian had gone to the dance or to the evening and had come across my mother, and Ian had met one of my older brothers in Lismore many years ago, and so he was quite, you know, taken back that he'd met Mrs. Hunter, and he knew Vic Hunter, my brother. And Ian tells me that as I walked into the room, he just saw this huge big ball of light coming towards him, and he just was blown away, and he thought, wow, this is the person for me.
And were you equally as impressed by him?
No, I was not.
No, that's never the way with us, is it? No, us fellas, no. It takes a while, doesn't it?
It takes a while, but yeah. I was also engaged to be married to an amazing pilot by the name of Peter Kelly, who'd been flying in Papua New Guinea. And we were on our way to live in Dubai, and he'd been offered an opportunity to fly with Emirates. And so I was not looking for any other love affair. I was on my way to Emirates. And obviously my mother must have had a plan in the back of her mind, because when I came to sit at the table with her, she said, oh, and by the way, you know, this is Ian, and we're going to give Ian a lift home. And I just about fell through the floor, because I thought, here's my mother organising my life, and I'm living in a city, and Ian could be anywhere. It was a real shock, because as it turned out, Ian was at the end of our street.
So you were crazy about each other after a while. But then what happened? How did that go askew?
Well, it was, as I said, Ian had basically made up his mind that I was the person he was going to marry. I ended up breaking my engagement with Peter Kelly, and Peter Kelly went off and flew for Emirates and turned out to be a wonderful pilot for Emirates, and we've stayed in contact. But basically Ian and I decided, you know, we had so much in common because Ian's Indigenous as well, and you know, he's taught me to grow as a human being, and we felt a very strong bond. But most of all, it was my mother that was the real matchmaker, and her and Ian were fantastic. They were real friends. So everything was all planned for a big wedding on the Warrinoora River in Sydney, and then all of a sudden I had this urge to come back to Broome. And so I said to Ian, look, I need to get back to Broome. Something's calling me. And I came up here, and I think it was an interesting time because I became involved in that short period of time with the born-again church. And
you became a born-again Christian?
I became a born-again Christian.
And what did they think of your engagement to Ian?
Oh, well, I guess the church was also plotting that, you know, they've got their members and they want to pair up their members and form relationships and invest in the church. And so basically their story to me was, now that you've become a good born-again Christian, you need to get rid of the man of the world, namely Ian. And so Ian was evil. And
gee, everyone's conspiring to get you hitched up to someone, rather, aren't they?
Everyone's conspiring, yes.
Right. So they put the hard word on you to give Ian away.
Yeah, they put the hard word on me. And now Ian was obviously very, very broken-hearted. And he said to me, well, you know, if that's the situation, do you mind if I come to Broome and just say goodbye face-to-face?
Oh, oh.
Yeah. Oh, it's very sad. And you know, my mother was also very sad and very heartbroken. But Ian came up, and part of the church was that they'd, to some extent, pair you off with another person and you'd go and do Bible studies. And Ian said to me, when he saw, you know, Gary turn up, this gentleman, Gary Proctor, that the church had put me in contact, he says, you be careful. I think that guy's trying to crack onto you. And I said, no, you know, and he was right.
And you got married to this guy?
I got married to Gary Proctor, and
and how long did that last?
That lasted about 3 years. In about the third year, Gary and I moved to Kalgoorlie, and Gary took up a position as an artist with the local TAFE, and I was working with the Aboriginal Medical Service. And in about 1977, I was pregnant, and Ian and I stayed in contact. We were always very, very good friends, and we would communicate and talk about different issues, but Ian rang me up one day and he said, oh, look, there's an amazing job going in Sydney and I think you should apply for it. And I thought, oh, well, okay, let's see how we go. So I was about 7 months pregnant. I said to my husband and my mother who was living with us, I'm going to go and apply for this job and see how I go. And I did that, and I got a job, got a job. And so my family and I decided that we were going to relocate from Kalgoorlie to Sydney. So Ian was part of that mix in terms of helping me to get established, to find a home, to get sorted, to allow my mum to come and spend some time while my son was readjusting to the change and me starting a new job.
Well, sounds like you fell in love with you straight away, but was very steadfast after that.
Yeah, no, I think Ian always had it in his mind that I was that person for him.
So when the marriage broke up, how quickly did you and Ian reconnect?
Well, you know, my mum and Ian were great friends. And Ian fell in love with my son and just loved my son. And he's, you know, he's been a wonderful, wonderful dad to my son. And basically he's looked after him since he was about 2 months old.
Well, you were hopping around the place a fair bit, you know, from Perth to Kalgoorlie to Sydney and all and around the place. You almost went off to Dubai. While you're all doing that, were you missing your country? Were you missing Broome as well?
No, because I've got this little theory in my head, wherever you go, you'll be there. And so I go with, you know, I grab every opportunity with two hands and I open my heart up to whatever is out there. You know, there was no regrets. It was just a progression in my life and it seemed to have worked out. And, in terms of Gary came and he decided he wanted to go and do a master's in fine arts. And he turned up one day and he says, I'm going to go back to your people. And I said, well, what people? And he said, in the desert, to Warburton. And I said, to Warburton? I said, they're not my people, they're the desert people. And we sort of sat there and we talked for a few hours, and then he said to me, well, I've fallen in love with a beautiful East Timor lady. And I said, well, you know, I mean, life is so short and love is so rare. If that's what you need to do, then both you've got my blessing for both of you to go to Warburton and create a new life. And, you know, I'll pack up and head back to Broome and see where that goes.
Was it lovely to be back in Broome, though?
It was lovely to be back in Broome, and we went via Perth at the same time when I told Ian that Gary was on his way. He saw that as an opportunity. So we went and spent a couple of years in Perth before coming back to Broome, but it was wonderful to come home.
Tell me about the dream you had on the first night you were back in your country.
That takes me back. 7 years later, having had a phone call from my cousin brother Robert Watson to come back to our traditional land. So in between Broome, there was this movement around. I had gone over to Lismore, had worked in Brisbane. But here we are back in about 1999, out on our remote community called Bulganja or Lower Liveringa. And we'd come at the invitation of my cousin brother Robert Watson, and we decided, okay, let's try and rejuvenate what we have in terms of that was my mother's country, that was my mother's land, that's where my grandmother had grown her children up, that's where we had formed a very intimate relationship with our land. And the land had actually, the community actually had been allowed to rest because Robert's father, my uncle Ivan Watson, had passed away. And so it had laid quiet for a number of years. And so we'd come back, and I remember driving through the night and driving down the old dirt road, and all of the wattle trees had almost wedded together. It was like we were driving through a tunnel of wattle. And because we have a deep relationship with nature, we have a connection to different totems or different animals that we have a connection with. So one of the things that was really unique, and it still happens today, but Robert's father's what we call jarinj or totem was a little owl. And as we were driving down this wattle tunnel, in front of us was an owl had just arisen from the ground and was flying in front of us, almost leading us all the way to the community. And so, you know, that day we had been clearing up and spent a lot of time, you know, reorganizing and doing lots of work and tidying the property. And we lay down to sleep. And I remember, you know, we'd been laying outside near the campfire, and I had this amazing dream. It was almost like being wide awake in a dream. And in the dream, what was happening was I looked out across the community, and there was a field of Aboriginal people, and they were all happy, and there was a big corroboree going on, and people were singing, and, you know, people were saying, welcome, welcome, you belong here. And it was really amazing. It just seemed to go for hours as if I was amongst and walking amongst a dream of my ancestors who were embedded in that place, and their memory was still very much alive. And so in that dream, I had a sense of welcome to country from my ancestors, from the land, and from the people who've walked that land so many generations before me.
In around 2013, there was a proposal to build a huge liquid natural gas facility about 60 k's outside of Broome at James Price Point. This was a proposal that left the community in the Kimberley, in Broome in particular, very, very divided. Where were you on that struggle?
Yeah, no, there was an interesting time in our history of Broome. And as I said, I was living out on our remote community, building life, building our business, building the opportunity to work out there. And then I heard this story, and I had been involved in it with the Kimberley Land Council, because one of the things the Kimberley Land Council was looking to do was bring all the Aboriginal people from the Kimberley together to look at a range of different sites where there could be the potential to house the gas hub. And so Aboriginal people had come and been in conversation, and then all of a sudden there was a change of government when Colin Barnett, the Premier, came into power, and he seemed to be very hard-nosed at going for James Price Point, for Walmerdon. And so that created quite a lot of conflict between the town, because there were people who were living out there who had spent quite a lot of time, who were the guardians and the custodians of Walmerdon, not necessarily, as we have found more recently from a legal finding, they may not have been determined as the traditional owners, but they had a deep relationship. They'd formed the Lurajari Trail. Paddy Rowe had been there as one of the main leaders who had been gifted that land from previous custodians. And so it was a very beautiful place. And I thought about the proposal, and I thought, look, this is only, you know, roughly about 60 k's up the coast. So if such a big development was going to come to Broome, how would that change the environmental conditions and the type of life that people in Broome, the families of Broome, have come to know and love? And the more I started to unpack what that development might look like, I thought the cost was too great. I'm not a traditional owner for Broome, but Broome is my home, and I'll defend it to my dying breath. And so I thought, look, you know, one of the things my people say is that if you have the capacity, you have to stand, which means that if you've got the skills to be a leader and you feel that there is a moment in time when you must stand for justice, then you must do that. So I was very heavily involved in James Price Point in regards to wanting to look at what that sort of development would do for the Kimberley coastline, and in particular, what would be some of the potential destructive elements that could occur from that development, because it was touted to be the largest LNG precinct in the world, a $46 billion project that would be bigger than Qatar. And so what we're talking about on a global scale is a massive development that would change not only the cultural landscape but the social cohesion and the civil society of Broome. And so I made a choice to look at that. But as I said, the most destructive element for me was the collateral damage and the destruction that touted Aboriginal families against each other, father against son, brother against brother, sister against sister. And so
A few family barbecues that sort of ended in uproar, weren't there?
Yeah.
More than a few, right throughout the community, not just amongst Aboriginal people. Have those divisions started to heal now, now that the project isn't going to go ahead?
I think there's, people who live in Broome are very civil and are looking at, I guess it's about how you treat people with respect and dignity. I've always upheld that people have a right to have a different point of view, and at the end of the day, it is what it is, and I guess it takes me back to being reassured that time is in a circular storytelling way and that the land really is in charge of the humans, and at some point we'll see some sort of resolution in terms of where this goes.
Well, this brings me to the next one. You touched on this right at the start, which is this idea of what you call a great Australian story, a bigger Australian story that we can start telling ourselves and we ought to start telling ourselves. Tell me what you mean by that.
It is all about that. And I guess one of the big things is this challenge for us as Australians to redefine who we are in modernity. And, there's conversations at the moment in regards to looking at how our governments are governing the people and for whose benefits. And I guess some of that conversation is that it's a conversation in terms of a great struggle between the powerful elites and ordinary everyday citizens. And
well, the national conversation at the moment has become, I think, particularly small and bitchy. It's something really small about the way we talk about Australia at the moment. You want to kind of leap over that and talk about a larger idea of
Australia.
Yeah,
no, I do want to talk about a larger idea, because my conversation in regards to all of this, as I said, is about how do we reclaim our democracy? How do we create greater civic participation? How do people in the regions get to form a regional governance, regionalism that allows people from the region to make the decisions about what sorts of developments should come to the regions, what's sustainable, not just sustainable development, but what is going to be sustainable life. So for me, there's a real need, as I said earlier, for us to really sit down and think about how do we increase that civic participation. I don't think people are aware, but one of the things that was looking at coming on the agenda when we were talking about constitutional reform for Aboriginal people was a constitutional reform around local government. And so there is this conversation that's still lying quite dormant. And this is what I saw come to play in the James Price Point story. What I saw was the domination of the state over local government and our inability as citizens to be able to truly be empowered to make the best decisions for what is good for our community, what is good for our region, and what is good for the greater good of Australia.
Well, Perth's a very long way from here, and in Perth there's a lot of complaints about the overweening dominance of Canberra upon that as well. So you're calling for a kind of greater localism, more power to the regions and to local government then?
I am calling for a greater call for, developing better civic participation, and that has to happen at the local government level. I think one of the things within local government is that there is an opportunity, if local governments were to combine, to form a regional government now. So those sorts of conversations are there. They're, as I said, they're dormant. They're not really being invigorated. But I think, when you look at some of the conversations that are happening nationally that have been happening for quite a time around regionalism and the Republic, I think Australians are waking up in terms of how do we define ourselves in a modern Australia. And what I say is that unless people are connected to the landscape and have a value and an appreciation for the original inhabitants of this country, they can't be truly Australians. So this is about trying to bring it together so that we don't have a divide between Indigenous versus non-Indigenous, but that we stand together around a collective regionalisation of we as Australians. Why don't we start to be a little bit innovative and think in terms of this landscape? Why not have a council of elders who are advising Parliament so that we've got a way to frame how we develop this land, how we work forward, how we continue to create civic participation from this voice of collective wisdom that has grown from this landscape. So I'm all for eldership and wisdom. So what I'm saying is that I think we need to make this a little bit Australian-centric, and I think the timing is really right in terms of, you know, just in my lifetime, I know before I started work, like, I've been a you know, as you said, I have three master's degrees. I started in nursing. I have a PhD. I'm now completing another PhD. So I've been very, very fortunate in terms of coming through the Whitlam era, having free education and seeing all of these things. And now I see my own children, particularly my daughter, who's out there, you know, doing her Juris Doctor in law. And when she graduates, she'll have $100,000 debt. The idea that many young people will possibly never own their own home. So I'm trying to conceptualize all of these sorts of thoughts and thinking, what does justice mean? What does equity mean? What does freedom mean? And I kind of think here we are in a lucky country that has been abundant in resource, and we have a huge national debt. And I'm kind of wondering, well, the leadership and the governance that we have had in charge for 200 years, where is that going? So what I'm saying is that I think we need to have a little bit of liberation in our own thinking and redefine what freedom means as Australians. And I think that the time could be right where we need to start to look at how are we going to create greater opportunities for ordinary, everyday people, Indigenous and not.
Recently, the author Richard Flanagan gave a speech at Garma in Northern Territory where he said that the country at large, why wouldn't it want to avail itself, plug into 60,000 years of Indigenous knowledge of Australia, all that body of experience, culture and knowledge? Why wouldn't we want to fully embrace that? Is that what you're saying as well?
Yeah, no, I think it's, like you said, it's a great body of wisdom and knowledge in terms of, you know, all of the science and a lot of the work that Bruce Pascoe has come out with to show that we had Indigenous farmers, we had a form of agriculture, we have, as I call it, Indigenous science. And when I talk about Indigenous science, what I'm talking about is traditional ecological knowledge that's been built up of thousands and thousands of years of knowledge production, but also adaptation and mitigation. And I think what we're saying as Indigenous people is that we have a gift of wisdom that we want to bring to fellow Australians so that they can reach their full potential as human beings, that they can see that there is an opportunity to transition away from the destruction of our planet towards the new economies around, you know, bioprospecting, cultural tourism. And this is an amazing place, the Kimberley. The scientific work that I've been doing is around the fact that the Fitzroy River is a globally unique river system. So, you know, concepts around geoparks. So, yeah, let's just have some time with Indigenous people. Let's get to share our wisdom and knowledge, not just between each other, but with the nation generally.
Great to speak with you, Anne. Fascinating to hear your story. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard. Galio Mabu.
Dr. Anne Polina is the Managing Director of Indigenous not-for-profit organisation based in Broome called Majula.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.